Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
On the record.
On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
Time to go through this morning's newspapers. We're joined on the line by Lise Hand, who's a political columnist, and by Elaine Loughlin, who's the deputy political editor with the Irish Examiner. Good morning to you both, ladies, and thank you very much for joining me this morning, and happy Easter to you both. Elaine, there is an awful lot written today about vaccine rollout and where the public generally stands in all of this. What jumps out at you this morning?
I found Robbie's interview there, I think, and it's featured in the papers. With all respect to Mr. Reid, I think the lack of clarity coming from both government and NPHET and health experts is probably annoying people now. And we see that poll in the Sunday Independent. And it has been commented on, and I know that the vintners, when they were before an Oireachtas committee 2 weeks ago, mentioned this. If a certain percentage of the population, if that were to be given as a target to work towards, and, you know, if we got certain cohorts, if we were told we had certain when we have certain cohorts vaccinated, we can reopen the pubs or we can meet people or a certain restriction will be eased, then it would give people something to work to.
So if there was a stated target, and the fact that there isn't one is the problem.
Exactly, exactly. And telling people, you know, that April will be crucial and to stick with it just is a bit disheartening at this stage, I think, for most people, because they wonder, well, if we stick with it through April, will we be told the exact same thing in May? Whereas if we were told once we get cohort 7 vaccinated, there will be a significant easing and we will look to, as I said, maybe open restaurants or provide, you know, ease other restrictions. And I think that's touched upon in the results of the poll in the Sunday Independent on the front page, where 50% believe that restrictions are being lifted too slowly. Now, you have to say that, well, if 50% believe that it's moving too slowly, perhaps the other 50% believe that we're okay, or perhaps we're going too fast. But the most significant piece in that poll or number in that poll came from the 43% approval rate of the government's actions around this. And that's the first time that it's gone below 50%. So it's clear that we're no longer in this we're all in this together mode of tackling the virus or addressing the virus. And that's as well as mentioned in a lot of the papers as well today. I picked out Justine McCarthy's piece in the Sunday Times as well, where she mentioned an RTÉ Radio 1 show Paddy O'Gorman used to have called Queuing for a Living. And she mentions in it that, you know, Paddy would go to whatever queue, whether it was the Dole queue, and bring his microphone along. And she says that there's one glaring exception in these reports. The voices of the rich and powerful, who otherwise dominate the national airways, were never heard. And she says queues, you see, are not for them. And I think that's what's coming through in whether it's the reporting from the Mail, the Irish Mail, Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday over the Beacon controversy and queue skipping or queue jumping or perceived queue jumping, and then this lack of faith in the government's approach now, that has that is seen in that poll today, Gavin.
That's an illustrative lamenting sigh I think you just gave there a moment ago. One thing that I find very striking, I mentioned this in the introduction, but it's worth just dwelling on again. You mentioned 43% of people currently approve of the coronavirus response by the government. That's at its lowest point now since they've done any of these polls. They've done 9 of them in the last 12 months. But also the number of people who disapprove of the government's response is precisely equal at 43% compared to those who do approve. Lise, one thing that jumps out at me, though, when you're dealing with opinion polls like this, is that we've been here before, and that opinion polling and public mood doesn't always correlate with how exactly to best manage a pandemic. And maybe there's a sense that the government is damned if it does and damned if it doesn't, because if it does what is popular, then it's going to be leaving the country vulnerable again, and it finds itself then in a very difficult situation.
I mean, absolutely. I think that the government at the moment will probably be praying that this is, to use the hackneyed cliche, the absolute snapshot in time, this particular poll, because it very much reflects, I think it was done in at the end of, you know, what had turned into a fairly bad spell for the government, particularly because of all the furore, correctly the furore over the Beacon, and then more revelations about the coup, and then this new revelation today in the front of the Mail on Sunday about a Limerick place. So I think that I think it's interesting that the argument or so on is, or the discussion is now turning to, as you just had actually with Paul Reid, the notion that the government is now pivoting to the age, to giving the injections by age. And I think this is very much this is definitely a step to try and stop the lobbying and create a sense of fairness, because everybody, the one thing unfortunately that is unchangeable is everybody's age. And, you know, so if they actually roll it out by age, to a certain extent, it stops the unhappiness of different cohorts who feel they should be in the, because they are frontline workers and they should be prioritized. Because, you know, again, you have the argument could be made, you have a 25-year-old teacher, do they deserve the vaccine over a 55-year-old meat packer or somebody who works in a supermarket? So when you have, I think, the cohort situation, you always have, to use the George Orwell phrase, all animals are equal, but, blah, blah, blah. Exactly. So you will always have groups that will put those arguments before. I mean, we see in the papers today that in the Sunday Independent, the piece about the guards by Maeve Sheehan, the armed guardie had to retreat when they went to arrest somebody, and it turns out that person was suffering from the virus. And this is used as, this is used as an example of, look what we have to face.
Well, there's another awful example. I don't mean to interrupt your waylay there, but there's another awful example in that piece of people who went to a particular public area in the last couple of days to try and break up what many people would have seen as a fairly harmless, fairly sort of open air gathering, a spontaneous thing where the weather was good and people were out sitting in a public area. And some of the guards who were unable then to break up that crowd went back to their cars and discovered that somebody, that there was loads of spit and mucus basically all over the door handles, which was almost like an inflammatory illustration of just what the Gardaí are dealing with when they're trying to keep themselves safe as much as everyone else.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. They are more likely to have to get into maybe sort of up close and personal situations with people on a daily basis. But I think if the government find themselves in this pickle where, as the poll suggests, people's impatience is running out, they're getting very impatient. They want this to be, if not over, at least see some progress. They're probably looking at Mike Ryan from the WHO, who basically in a nutshell said speed trumps perfection. And the thinking seems to be that if you just go by age, they can speed this up. They can get more needles into more arms at a quicker rate. And even the cohorts that feel that they have been hard done by now will have a jab within 3 months. I think this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to say, OK, this may be unfair, but it's unfair in a short term because we are now hopefully, and there's a hopefully is a big lift here. The vaccine supplies will speed up. They will be getting 1.25 a month, or a million a month, or whatever the target figure is. And that target figure will be met, which it wasn't this month. Yeah. It fell short by about 300,000 vaccines. So I think their thinking with this is, be damned the poll, let's just motor on. It doesn't matter if we trample on a few people's toes at the moment. Let's just get the needles into arms and let's get beyond 3 months where the picture looks sunnier, and then hopefully, if the government, and again, this is a big if, the government hangs together in the foreseeable, the next, a few polls down the road will look a bit better.
What I'm immediately struck by is the fact that you've managed to explain the government stance way better than the government has. If somebody from the government had only stood up and said, well, speed trumps perfection, and that's why we're changing the vaccine queue, I think they would have won over a lot more people than they've found themselves doing. Some brand new figures just published, by the way, by the HSC. 27,915 vaccines issued on April Fool's Day. That's Thursday just gone, bringing the nationwide cumulative total to 893,000. You'll have heard Paul Reid tell me in the first part of this show that there were over 30,000 vaccines issued on Good Friday, which would bring the national total to around 920,000 or so. Let's talk about mandatory hotel quarantine. Still joined on the line by Elaine Lockton and Mike Lee's Hand. Elaine, the government seems betwixt and between about whether to add countries that have large Irish populations like France, Italy, Germany and the United States from being added to the mandatory hotel quarantine list. Can you explain, just so people can get their heads around it, what exactly the debate or the quibble is here?
Yes, and I know it's difficult for two civil war parties to just forget about the past, but it appears this week they weren't even speaking to each other, because we had an indication from Stephen Donnelly's side of government and the Department of Health that a number of EU countries, France, Germany and Italy, had been mentioned that they would be added to the list of hotel quarantining countries. Almost immediately afterwards, Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney came out and said that he hadn't been consulted. And as Minister for Foreign Affairs, he would have to be consulted. Yeah. And then, of course, we had the AG got involved in the issue as well and said there could be difficulties legally with prohibiting EU citizens from entering the country without having to go into hotel
this
quarantine.
This is despite Austria already being on the list anyway.
Yes, which is curious, because it was among the first countries to be added to the list, or it was on the first list. So it does seem like the issue may have been with France, because as reported by the Sunday Times today, there's 700 Irish students currently on Erasmus in France, and they will be coming home at the end of April. So if France were to be added to the list, you'd have all of those Irish students, and presumably parents having to pay roughly €2,000 to put them up in these hotels for 10 days after they come home. Now, that's just speculation, but it probably, I'm guessing, was a significant consideration in all of this. And as you mentioned, Gavin, we now have this variant from
this Breton variant,
Exactly. That is another worry, and will have to be addressed by the government. Considering the latest list, there was a lot of commentary on it. It included the likes of Israel, which we know is the world's vaccination leader at the moment, and they are having a great time over there. Pubs and restaurants and all the rest are open with very little transmission. So there was question marks as to why the likes of Israel and other tiny states such as Monaco were added to the list, and other countries where you can't get a direct flight to Ireland from were added. But the likes of France, Germany and Italy, that have significant COVID infection rates at the moment and indeed are moving to lockdown themselves, were not included.
Is Israel, by the way, just to sorry to interrupt you, Elaine, Israel, by the way, as of a couple of days ago, despite all the progress that it had made with vaccinations, and the numbers are plunging all the time because as more people get vaccinated, then the level of transmission thankfully falls as well. But they had basically pro rata about the same number of cases as Ireland had in the fortnight up to a couple of days ago. So maybe we sort of overlook the fact that the virus is still, you know, circulating at the same rate, albeit perhaps in younger populations, which is why there's less of a concern about it.
Yes, and it was actually something that Stephen Donnelly pointed to when he was talking about this country in the Dáil recently enough. And he indicated that across the summer months and maybe into the autumn, we could have significant daily rates of infection in this country. But we will not be focusing on the 500 or the 600 daily cases that we now have. But we'll be more focused on hospitalizations and ICU rates as to base restrictions on, because as younger cohorts get infected and older and more at-risk cohorts are vaccinated, those numbers of hospitalizations and ICU figures will plummet dramatically. And you have to remember, we don't count infections for the flu every year, because people get it and thankfully they might be housebound for a week or two, but it doesn't put them in hospital. And that's what's hoped will happen with COVID.
Lise, where do you stand on this sort of debate between the pragmatism or the diplomacy of not wanting to inconvenience Irish students who are coming home from Erasmus and the fact that, well, the law says that you can add these countries to the list if they've got a high incidence rate, and we see how high it is in Paris at the moment?
Well, this is it. I think a lot of people might say, well, what's the fairer outcome on this? You inconvenience 700 Erasmus students, or you inconvenience the entire population of the Irish Republic. Yeah. You could see the battle lines were drawn. There was obviously a fierce amount of lobbying. Apparently embassies in Paris and Berlin and Rome were, you know, inundated with calls from Irish citizens, concerned about when they heard about this. But I think the government priority, I would imagine, is to try and emerge relatively unscathed out of lockdown as soon as it's practicably possible and safe to do so.
Like, I don't remember the United States having the same hand-wringing when they eventually added the UK and Ireland to their travel ban list last spring. So why would the same not be true now?
Well, I mean, exactly. And, you know, you look at France going back into lockdown, Italy declaring itself a red zone, Germany in trouble. And, you know, once that there's legal maneuvers there that they can actually restrict travel or put in mandatory quarantines for these countries, I think there's a very strong case to do so, because by keeping these, particularly the ones that can elude the PCR test, but by keeping variants out of Ireland, it's going to help the vaccination program. I mean, you know, they seem... The focus is on the vaccination program. Anything that's going to impede this, like new variants escaping and sort of getting into the community, you would think that they would be closing off every route. Mm. And I think they would get the gratitude of the people who actually live here if they take robust steps to ensure that new variants don't get into the community. And it goes really back to what I was saying earlier on about treading on toes. I think they really need just to find a bit of spine on this and, you know, on several other matters relating to sort of the containment of the virus and the rollout of the vaccine. I think they just need to stand up to lobbyist groups, to outraged people, and just say, look, we're focused on getting this vaccine out, and anything that basically will hinder, impede this rollout, we're just going to deal with it in a robust fashion. I think that should be the approach.
Prepared to put trade union noses out of joint over the reorganisation of the queue. Maybe they need to be prepared to put other noses out of joint in some of the European capitals. We have a couple of minutes left, and I want to talk about a couple of party political issues. Elaine, I'll start with yourself. There's a good interview that Justine McCarthy has done with the Labour Party leader, Alan Kelly. I don't know at what point in the week she conducted the interview, because Alan Kelly remarks that maybe he's mellowing as he gets older, which wouldn't be the impression that you'd get if you heard him addressing Stephen Donnelly in the all on Thursday morning, but he's talking about how it may not still be too late for him to become Taoiseach one day. Your thoughts?
Well, I suppose if you're the leader of any party, isn't that what you hope to go on to become one day, is Taoiseach? Whether that happens or not, I don't know. And my colleague Daniel McConnell had a column in yesterday's Irish Examiner about this. The fact that Labour seem to be stuck on around 4-5% in the polls since last year, despite the fact that Alan Kelly has been one of the strongest voices in the Dáil, both on the COVID issue and other issues. I'm thinking around cervical check. He has campaigned strongly on that issue, and also bringing up more recently the fact that there is this what seems to be daft system for recruiting vaccinators, where they're asked for everything down to their junior cert results.
Another issue I'd have loved to put to Paul Reid if I'd had time earlier. I suppose the big Labour hindrance though here, Elaine, and to get to the nub of it, that they effectively, because of the stance they have in the Dáil, they get the same level of exposure almost in terms of parliamentary coverage as Sinn Féin do, and yet Sinn Féin are running rings around them when it comes to the polls.
Mm-hmm. And whatever's happening, that really effective voice that they do have in the Dáil and Shannon at the moment is not translating into votes, or certainly not when the public is polled. It doesn't seem like that the work that they're doing in the Dáil and Shannon is translating into support for the party. So whether they need to up their Twitter and social media game, like Sinn Féin have been doing for many years now. Mm. They've really been ahead when it comes to the social media platforms and getting people supportive of their policy and their party that way. It does seem like they need to do something. And I know that they had planned on holding a conference around this time of the year. But that obviously is postponed until the autumn. And there's words that there may be some sort of a relaunch of the party, not a complete relaunch, but maybe a bit of an overhaul to give them a fresh, a revival, to give them a fresh face. And they're really pinning their hopes on that now.
One text into 53106 says the USA is way ahead of all EU countries in terms of vaccination. So the idea of trying to introduce a travel ban there for them would be absolutely tokenistic. Lise, I have about 40 seconds left. You picked out Aidan Corkery's piece in the Business Post about the Green Party and the malaise that they have at the moment.
Well, yes. I mean, the Green Party are, once again, they're in the headlines for all the wrong reasons. You think having basically kind of got their way in an awful lot of the issues to do with the climate bill and so on, that they'd be on a victory lap around Merrion Square. But no, no, no. They're, once again, they're sort of in a state of internecine warfare between over the over Hazel Chu, the chairperson of the party who's running for, and Dublin Lord Mayor, who's running for the Shannon. And again, this is sort of playing out in the public arena, and it just never ceases to I suppose just to astonish me at their ability to just to turn a good news to, you know, a good news story into sort of something that reflects badly on them. And you know, so it's just one of these rows. I mean, the Shannon, let's face it, Gavin, you and I know.
Shannon elections, they generally don't matter a huge amount. No,
they don't matter a huge amount. And they seem to always generate all kinds of dangers and perils for political parties. I mean, we could go back to, as Adrian Corky mentioned, you know, Enda Kenny. I mean, he found himself in deep trouble over a Shannon's election back in 2014. John McNulty, and there was all kinds of accusations of stroke politics. Over his appointment to the board of the Irish Museum of Modern Art just before a run for the Shannon. And, you know, here we are again. This is, you know, a Shannon election should have been nice and straightforward. There was a nice little cosy arrangement between the three government parties that there would be candidates that would be selected. Everybody'd vote for everybody else. And the job was OXO, and the Greens would get their turn next time around on the carousel when a vacancy came up. And then, anyway, in steps Hazel Chu decides to run, and all holy hell breaks loose in the party. You've got one side voting against the other, and we're once again, they're in the headlines instead for all the chaotic reasons.
So someday they'll figure out how to fill Shannon seats without managing to obliterate themselves in the foot. We will leave it there. Lise Hand, political columnist, and Elaine Lockley, deputy political editor of the Irish Examiner. Thank you both very much.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.